Commander Rappard, Real 19. We were talking about your time as the Boys Divisional Officer, Drake Division on HMS Granges at Shotley, the shore station. And you were telling me about the mast drill. How high you got as far as the mast was?
The top of the mast was about 130 feet up. The lower rigging had ratlins between them, and ratlins are bits of rope between wire shrouds holding the mast up. So you could run up that quite easily. And when you got there, there was a thing called a fighting top, which Nelson would have known about because he got shot from one. And as you got up the ratlins, you had two ways of getting on top of the fighting top. One was to go out backwards on the futtock shrouds and over the edge, and therefore onto the fighting top. The other was to go through the lubber's hole, which had a sort of hatch you go through, which wasn't done, of course. So you had to go backwards like a fly and go over the edge. And I wasn't too sure of my ability to do this, but here I was ordered to lead my boys over the mast, and so did it. I did. Frightened to death I was. And then there was a further set of rigging where you went up another 40 feet or so. And I decided that shinning up the pole was not going to be my seed. And anyway, there were others behind me, so that wouldn't be on. So I went up to the next one, the cross trees, and down the other side again and led them down, going outside over the futtock shrouds again on the way down. Much relieved to think that there was a safety net spread underneath this thing, which, being in the Navy, was not sagging in any way. It was absolutely bar taut. And I was glad it was a net. I didn't really think about it. So having led my boys over, I then found that one of them had stuck. And he'd stuck on the futtock shrouds. And he'd wrapped his arms around them and his legs around them. And he couldn't go up and he couldn't go down. So everybody else went away, and I was left there with my chief of the officer and the boy stuck. And I said, what do we do now, chief? Oh, he'll come down for his dinner. I'll put his dinner at the bottom of the shrouds, and he'll come down for it in due course. So we leave a sentry here. So we left a sentry here and his dinner at the bottom. And half an hour later, he was still stuck on the futtock shrouds when I came out to look. So I went up to him, tried to persuade him to come down, and he said he couldn't, he was frightened. He was quite obviously frightened. So my chief petty officer said, oh, it's all right, I'll go and get him down, sir. So he went up, and he put his arms, just putting his arms around outside the boy, so the boy was clinging against the rigging and the chief was outside him, and said, that's all right, son. Well, without warning, the boy let go of everything, pushed the chief off into the netting, and he fell 30 or 40 feet into that. Climbed down and said, are you all right, chief? Well, he wasn't. He had a badly dislocated shoulder because going into this bar-taut netting did him a lot of no good at all. So I treated this mast drill with considerable respect after that, but the boys didn't. The boys thought it was enormous fun to go up all the rigging there was and then to shin up the top pole, which was about 8 inches across, and get right up onto the top where there was a bunt, which was a sort of button at the top. And sticking up out of the button, there was a lightning conductor. And they put the lightning conductor up their trouser leg, then took one foot off and pretended the wind was blowing them round, 130-odd feet above the deck. And this was allowed because it encouraged them to be independent, and nobody got killed. So perhaps it was the right thing, but I'm damned if I'd have done it for all the tea in China. When I was sent up to the masthead of my first ship as a midshipman, I had been very frightened indeed.
Now, can you comment a bit about the syllabus the boys went through?
They spent about a year there. We had boy seamen and boy signalmen there. And they had a slightly different syllabus in the sense that the signalmen had to learn to make signals, and they were broken down into wireless ratings and whatever the others were called, the ones who pulled the flags up and down. And they all had to learn about boats. They all had to learn the drill in a ship, how ships were organized, and they all had to do boat work. because they had to get a feel for the sea as such. They were very interesting because and they all had to swim because they couldn't be promoted unless they'd passed a swimming test. The thinking behind that at the time was that if a sailor went into the sea and somebody else had to go in after him because he couldn't swim, he'd probably lose two of them. And so the physical training instructors in the very large bath we had there, swimming pool, closed swimming pool, were very, very strict indeed on their passing the swimming tests. And they had to swim a length in clothes and so on. And some of them couldn't do it. Some of them were really, really frightened. And in order to make certain that this was not a psychological problem, or whether it was a psychological problem or something else, they would be pushed off from the side. And if they put their fingers on the side, some of the PTIs would stand on their fingers. And the whole time I was there, there was only one chap who really, really failed in this thing. And he was a case, it transpired, which he was worried much more about a family problem than about anything else to do with swimming or anything else. He'd been a very good swimmer at his school, but he lost the plot a bit as a boy. And it turned out that this was a family problem at home, and I became involved in that. And I found myself on the opposite side to his Member of Parliament. As the boys' divisional officer, I had letters from the mother and from his sister saying if he can possibly stay in the Navy, it would be the best possible thing for him. And I had formal letters to the captain from the Member of Parliament saying that this boy was being exploited by the Navy and being held in against his will. He was needed by his father to help the father in the jeweler's shop or the watch shop that the father ran. And the mother and the sister were saying, father's a four-letter man, and in those circumstances, keep him if you can. So we got mother down, the Admiralty expense, to look at all this. And at about that time, the boy was in the sanatorium with psychologists looking after him and a sick bay. And he got his lanyard, which was part of their uniform, which has a slip knot, put it round his throat, tied it to the top of his iron bedstead, put his toes under the bottom of the iron bedstead, and pulled down until it tightened on his neck until he became unconscious, when, of course, his toes relaxed and the slip knot slipped back the other way, so he came round again. They couldn't understand because the thing was under his pillow and they couldn't see it till somebody thought to look. They found out what he was doing. And when mother arrived to have a look at the thing, we got her through the gate and I went to meet her, and the boy was with me meeting her. And she took one look at the mast, which we had to walk past, and she said, you mean make them climb that and pass out herself? So quite clearly it ran in the family. And the poor boy was discharged on medical grounds. But it was the rare event. This, out of the 2,000 boys, there was the only one that had this sort of problem. And it was a family problem, horrid to deal with.
What was your role, would you say?
As divisional officer, I was the officer to whom all the boys looked for leadership in Drake Division. They could very easily be enthused to be the best team, the hardest trained. They championed themselves. You must remember that at that time, beating was still part of the Naval Discipline Act and could be carried out. The rules by which it was carried out reflected the old rules for saying that a man was fit to receive punishment of flogging. And therefore, I couldn't award punishment of beating with a cane, but the commander could and the captain could. And I believe the captain could award 3 dozen strokes with a cane. The commander had a dozen, I think, but normally it was half a dozen. And the drill was that the doctor had to examine the man under punishment to see that he was fit to receive punishment, This had to be witnessed by the divisional officer, sometimes me. The cane was applied by the regulating petty officer, and the master at arms counted the strokes out loud. So it was a very formal, rather daunting business, to say the least of it. And it didn't daunt the little boys one bit. These were 15 and a half to 17-year-old, I say little. And I found that boys in my division, anyway, having had this punishment, would actually make money out of it by exposing their bottoms for a penny a look to their friends. So, as it didn't modify their behavior for which they'd been punished, it simply wasn't working. So I let it be known that one of the sort of stroppy gang leader type of boys who'd been beaten and who'd got away with it, in effect, had in fact broken down and cried for his mummy, whereupon he lost all his credibility with his friends and ceased to be a nuisance, and therefore started to toe the line for entirely different reasons, so that I wouldn't, in effect, tell those sort of stories about him again. So you asked what my role was. It was really an extraordinarily powerful role with these petty officers, chief petty officers, and these. I had one warrant officer who'd been a sailor himself in my division. And we wished to win everything, please. And that was the objective. And when they caught German measles, I had to isolate the particular group of boys and mess of boys for that. So we had competitive snowman building, I remember, with the people concerned, probably of which there may be a photograph in here. But it was something which kept me at full tilt the whole time. And when Peggy and I got married, I used to spend really rather a lot of time at the establishment. I didn't get home very much, did I, Paul?
And you were enjoying the work, obviously.
Oh, yes, you could put your heart and soul into it and see these boys developing from, in effect, refugees from war into people who could really do things. One major event involved both Peggy and me, because for the first time it was thought we would have a dance, a Shotley dance. And I was put in charge of organizing the Shotley dance, and I had a boys' dance committee, and Peggy came along too, as we were going to try and find girls from all over the eastern counties for this party. And they asked, would she do one of the jobs? And so Peggy said, oh yes, she would. And blushingly they said, well, would she run the ladies' loo? And so her job was to run the ladies' loo. My job was to find the ladies who could come to the loo. So I approached Ransom and Rapiers and all the big employers all the way around the eastern counties. Said, I'll send buses for girls, please, and I'd like them to about 15 to 17, 18. And I got an awful reputation in South. However, when the time came for this dance to work, we were going to have it in a vast gymnasium. The girls were brought in by buses. The boys were already in the establishment, and they'd modified their uniforms so their chests stuck out a bit more, and their bell bottoms had darts put in the bottom to make them bigger around the feet. And we'd stopped all the leave of the Royal Marines on the establishment so they could beat the bushes around the gymnasium. And we put the girls in one end, the boys in the other, and about 25 feet apart, they would not cross the boundary and actually start the dance. The Royal Marine Band was playing in the background. Eventually, one of my boys, Bamba, strutted out from my side, from the boys' side, and went up to a girl, jerked her thumb at her, and said, "Want to dance?" And the dance started, and all the others, the ice was broken, and the party started. About 6 years later, in the Mediterranean, a hairy sailor came up to me with a full set of whiskers.
I said, "You remember me, sir?"
I said, "I'm terribly sorry, I don't."
"Boy Bamba, sir."
"I married her." So the dance obviously had been blessed by all sorts of things, and there were no scenes, and the girls duly got back to wherever they'd come from afterwards, with much relief all round, because this had been a great worry for the whole establishment, as you can imagine. But those type of entertainments were rare. We were snowed in fact, down to Shotley in 1947. And I had to deploy boys on the road to Ipswich to dig our way through 6 foot snowdrifts to open the road to Ipswich. And again, something for the boys to do. They worked as teams, and it was different. And they threw themselves into that with just the same marvelous enthusiasm. They threw themselves into virtually everything else. The one thing they would not put up with was thieving. And coming from the backgrounds that some of them did, they were light-fingered. And however much you said this was against the rules and so on, it occasionally happened. It never, to my knowledge, reached a naval charge and seen by the commander or came up to me. The boys dealt with it themselves. They made the thief run the gauntlet down the short covered way, which was past my office somewhere after I wasn't there, and they hit him with hockey sticks and cricket bats and solid lumps of something, and I don't remember any boy reaching the bottom of the short covered way before being taken off to hospital. So the amount of thieving in 2,000 boys' establishment was virtually zero in the end. They dealt with it their way. The thinking being that in a ship you have nowhere to lock up your gear. Everything is open to them, and they've got to be taught that that is not acceptable.
Anything else about your time there? You seem to have been there from about 1945 through to 47.
I was able to play games myself. I played tennis for the Nore Command and hockey for the Nore Command, and we had a couple of hockey players in the establishment who became Olympic players, and I kept in touch with them later because I was the naval hockey team too, later a naval tennis team and squash team. And I was able to play squash for Suffolk as well, and all that sort of thing. If you see a ball bounce and run after it, it's a great advantage, but it doesn't mean you're brilliant. It does mean you can see a ball bounce and run after it. And I had a lot of fun that way. Because I could do it, the boys wanted to emulate it in my division, and I think that's one of the reasons why they really tried and put their backs into it.
So when did you come to leave? I believe you went for a short spell training at HMS Raleigh, Torpoint.
I left Shotley and was appointed to join a ship in Londonderry. There was a gap, and I had some leave, and so we went on leave to Waterville and sent all our gear up to Londonderry.
So you left around about September?
About September. And I was due to join towards the end of September. So after fishing down in Kerry, Killarney, I got a very surprising telegram about 48 hours before I was due to be in Londonderry, telling me that I wasn't going to Londonderry at all. I was going to Raleigh down in just over the Torpoint Ferry in Cornwall to take over from a sick officer, and that I was to join only within 48 hours. And I had to ring up and say I couldn't do that because all my gear was in Londonderry and I was in Waterville, and we'd get there as soon as I could. So we drove up to Londonderry and went to Belfast, Heysham, where somebody dropped something very heavy on a car exactly like mine and squashed it. And we thought it was mine for a while, which was named Jim Midget. And then we stopped off at Tewkesbury Abbey because the vicar there had not only been to prep school with one of my brothers, but he'd also been at Shotley, and he'd married us. And then we went down to HMS Raleigh, where we took a small flat in the Plymouth side, Mutley Plain, from October to November 1947.
And what was your job at HMS Raleigh?
I was to take over as a divisional officer, looking after a whole lot of people who didn't want to be there and hadn't got a clear brief. I was meant to be doing some training. they didn't want to do the training, and I didn't really know what I was meant to be training.
Well, why didn't they want to be trained? What, who
it
were
It would
these
appear
people?
That they'd been kept there, and that the whole process of unwinding the war had been confused. I remained confused during the whole of my time there. So I was really quite pleased when they found somebody more permanent to take over from me after only a month or two. And by then, my possibility of starting my torpedo and anti-submarine course was coming forward, so I was between appointments. And in November 47, I was told to join HMS Nelson up in Scotland at Rosyth. She was lying out at anchor in Rosyth, and with another battleship, would never go to sea again, and was very concerned to get all the furniture which she'd picked up in America when she'd been damaged back to the Americans. And we spent an awful lot of effort getting this stuff ashore and making certain it was the right number of chests of drawers and everything else. And the Americans didn't want it at all, and they burnt it all. But it very time-consuming indeed. But it did mean that...
What was your job on the ship?
A watchkeeping officer. So that was all. I didn't have any sailors I was responsible for. I did keep watch from time to time. And I see from the photograph, which was taken on Christmas Day, 1947, the photograph's a little bit blurred, and I've recorded under it that the fog was alcoholic. So I think that it was very much a part-time job in which I had a huge cabin all to myself, but I was much more concerned about my wife staying at home, getting bigger and bigger as time passed, because
pregnant.
She was pregnant.
What about, how did you find it being on such a big ship? After all, you'd been on mostly fairly
so
small.
So wildly improbable. I never found my way around it completely in the time I was there, which was very brief. I really haven't there. Least idea.
So when did you leave the Nelson?
Well, I was appointed to join Vernon, additional for the long torpedo and anti-submarine course, to join on the 1st of February 1948. So I must have left Nelson during January in order to come down there.
Now, this is a long torpedo course.
Torpedo and anti-submarine course. It was a year and a quarter where we had to study torpedo warfare and anti-submarine warfare, mine warfare, explosives, diving, and mine countermeasures, mining. And... I see that in the middle of January, I was selected, while still in Nelson, to play hockey for the Navy against Surbiton. So I had to come all the way down from Scotland to play hockey, which was great fun, because two of the people in the team became Olympic players. And the one became and played for Scotland.
Now, how were torpedo and anti-submarine course? How was it changing? Were there
any
new
techniques? Well, as I knew so little about it originally, except that when I first went to sea, the torpedo men were responsible for the electrics in the ship. That had gone from the task, and that had, electrical officers, a special branch of electrical officers, been formed. They were certainly responsible for the torpedoes, which was a fairly easy one. And as this was only the second torpedo and anti-submarine course to be run, people were still feeling their way as to what we should learn. Certainly we should learn everything which the old specialists in anti-submarine warfare had learned, and they'd been based at Osprey before. So an amalgamation between Vernon, the torpedo school and electrical school, and Osprey, the anti-submarine school, had been brought into effect. But a lot of the training methods had dragged over from the past. For example, in order to become a torpedo officer, it was thought necessary that we should draw all the air leads inside a torpedo and know precisely what air pressure should be there at any one time. When we got down to the anti-submarine school, I had to draw a diagram of the amplifier of an ASDIC set, which seemed to me to be almost totally irrelevant to someone who was knowing how to use it, knowing how to kill submarines with the thing and make it work, if there were electrical specialists on board who knew about the circuitry.
Now, where was HMS Vernon?
Vernon was at Portsmouth and had been for a very long time indeed. It was the great rival of the gunnery school at Excellent, Whale Island, and it stayed that way. The rivalry remained for a very long time indeed. So I found myself back as a schoolboy, having been to war directly after leaving school, and really having done nothing terribly different except a bit of training with the boys, which was an entirely different thing, being turning into a schoolmaster as opposed to a schoolboy. I now found myself very much screwed down to do paperwork and learn things I didn't know much about, and I was horrified to find that we were just going to start by a little mathematical refresher course, because I'd never been terribly good at maths anyway. And so starting that way horrified me, and we went up to Greenwich for a bit where professors started to say things I didn't understand at all. As I never used it subsequently, I felt that perhaps the mathematical bit had been not aimed at the right people. There were those who became specialists and helped to design weaponry, and it was admirable for them, but actually not for me. What I enjoyed about it very much indeed is I happened to be the senior officer on this torpedo and submarine course. There were 18 of us. There were Australians and Canadians as well as Englishmen. One of them proved to be the brother of somebody I'd been at prep school with, rather to my surprise. And we were encouraged to be different as well as everything else. We had to imagine things. And later in the course, we were still being turned into developing young officers with power of command and so on, who had to think more widely than hitherto about naval affairs. And we were required to be able to stand up and lecture to anybody about almost anything. And we were asked what we would choose to lecture on. So everybody chose, and I chose something, and I was told it was going to be to the two other officers, more senior officers than ourselves. And then I was told that my subject wasn't acceptable because that had already been chosen for me as the senior boy, and that I was required to speak on leadership, discipline, and morale, which rocked me onto my heels a bit because it wasn't a theoretical subject to me. It was a very much a practical one. Then I found that I was going to be talking to several captains and that the Commander-in-Chief Portsmouth might come as well to the lecture I was going to give. So I burnt the midnight oil to a great extent reading authorities on this subject and trying to put together a talk. And eventually I did, absolutely scared stiff, but the Commander-in-Chief was a delightful man. Not all our members were conformists. One of the young officers was a brilliant sailor. He'd had an exciting war of various sorts as a midget submariner. At one stage during the Battle of the Bismarck, he had been charged with cowardice in the face of the enemy because he went over the side of Dorsetshire to help retrieve the German survivors. And not being conformist in his approach, he thought it'd be rather fun to put a chamber pot upside down over the captain's steaming chimney in his house in HMS Vernon and smoke the captain out of his house. That was not regarded well, to say the least of it, and his leave was stopped for an indefinite period. The next thing that happened was that Admiral Mountbatten, who by then was First Sea Lord, rang up Commander-in-Chief Portsmouth and said, I wonder why you can't make Joe Brooks available for the Olympic dinghy sailing trials. The Commander Chief Portsmouth didn't know and rang up the Captain of Portsmouth, who said, well, nobody had, Captain of Vernon, who said nobody had told him that Joe Brooks had been invited to do that. And so he said,